This is Doug Thorpe reporting in. This is part four, actually, of our discussion of Ken Kesey's novel One Flew Over the Cuckoo's Nest, set in the context of 1962 when the novel was published. And of course, a primary reason that we've been exploring Kesey's novel during this particular year is the 50th anniversary of Holden. And so we've also been putting this novel in the context of what else is going on in 1962. And a couple of examples tonight. This will be familiar, I think, to some of you. U.S.-Soviet showdown over Cuban Missile Crisis. Photos taken from a U.S. spy plane reveal the Soviets placing offensive missiles on Cuban soil. Sensing a direct challenge to U.S. resolve, Kennedy orders a naval quarantine around Cuba to prevent the Soviets from delivering additional missiles. In the tense days of the Cuban Missile Crisis, the world comes the closest it's ever been to nuclear annihilation, is the way it's put here. So 1962. So you have this showdown of sorts. It almost feels like a kind of Western showdown.
I remember.
Yeah.
Sitting in a college dorm room, a bunch of guys think we were going to be annihilated.
Yeah.
With the missile crisis. I mean, we just were sitting there waiting, just saying,
This is it. Yeah.
That's why I was telling him at supper that I was in Chicago going to school.
Yeah.
And it was the second city that was going to be bombed. And I called my mother and dad and said, I love you if I don't ever hear from you again.
Yeah. You just felt, it's gone.
Yes. Yeah. Big test tomorrow. So what?
Big deal.
Yeah. So you have that going on, which is huge. Another major event, of course, is and I was saying this yesterday. James Meredith enrolls at the University of Mississippi, the first African American to enroll at Ole Miss. And I was rereading in Parting the Waters, those of you who have not been part of our conversation, I've been referencing this book each day. Parting the Waters, America in the King Years, 1954 to 1963 by Taylor Branch. An amazing, amazing book, putting those years and the work of the civil rights movement sort of front and center, but also exploring other things that were going on as well. And of course, the integration of Ole Miss, again, some of you, this will be familiar territory. And it's astonishing when you think about it now. I mean, Oxford, Mississippi, when the word got out that James Meredith had officially been enrolled, a complete riot broke out in Oxford, Mississippi. And it took federal agents to come down and tear gas to finally quell the riot. I mean, the whole town went up in flames. Okay, you have one African American simply registering at Ole Miss. Okay? This is not that long ago, 1962. This is 50 years ago. I'm 9 years old, all right? And many of us in this room were alive. It's just not that long ago. Okay? And so one of the threads we've been following is the sense that that there was a veneer in the late 1950s, and again at dinner, somebody was saying this. I think it was you. Yeah. Just say a little bit about, your experience, 1958 to 1962.
Well, we went to Africa in 1958 and came back mid-1962, and it was a totally different country. Expected, to come home, and it was so different.
Yes.
Well, all the civil rights, the Soviet hairstyles, clothing, the music. I left in 58 knowing all the popular music. I was lost and have been ever since.
Never quite caught up, huh?
Never quite.
Beatles? Who are these Beatles? I don't know.
It was amazing. those 4 years. Then we went back to Africa in 63, and when we came back in 71, it just was...
Yeah, I can imagine.
Oh,
you can just imagine.
Oh, huge.
And one of the things we've been saying is 1962 is one of those threshold years. It's not a year like 1963 that everybody immediately has experience. I mean, immediately thinks, of course, the assassination of JFK in 1963 or 1968 or something. 1962, you know, until I started to really research it, so what happened in 1962? But in fact, there's clearly a tremendous upheaval, a groundswell of energy that is starting to kick up and had been, of course, throughout the late 1950s. And you do experience that in music as well. I mean, the rise of rock and roll, the civil rights movement. I mean, it was in music in the mid-1950s that you first experienced integration, basically. It was in rock and roll. Because, you would have concerts, especially in the South, where black artists would be performing, and there would be segregation that, black teenagers would be up in the balcony, white teenagers would be down below. Within about 10 minutes, everybody is dancing together, right? Mm-hmm. Right? And so musically, there's just this unbelievable upswell of energy. And then it already started to happen in jazz. Benny Goodman hires Teddy Wilson, a black piano player, the middle to the late 1930s. Right? Billie Holiday is a vocalist for Teddy Wilson's orchestra. And when they travel in the South, of course, she has to, use a separate end. I mean, all that stuff was going on. But it was starting to break down. And what was starting to arise also was this, and partly rage. And what's happening at Ole Miss, the riots by white students, is an indication of what has been just below the surface. Just below the surface. And something is clearly starting to crack. And in my sense is that what Ken Kesey accomplished in Cuckoo's Nest in 1962 was to take an image of this mental hospital, which becomes an image of the country in a certain way, and where there has been a strongly repressed society that is waiting for some kind of catalyst to crack this open. And in the novel, again, those of you who have not been following along, basic plot summary, again, the novel set in this mental institute. Into this place comes Randall P. McMurphy, who has actually been on a work farm. He's been in prison, and he kind of finagles his way into the mental institute where he doesn't have to work. I mean, that's his whole thing. It's like, oh, this is a great deal. I mean, I've got 45 days. I'm just going to hang out here, play cards with these guys, win a bunch of money off of them, and then 45 days, I'm out of here. What he didn't realize was that he was committed to the mental institute, and he does not have power over when he gets out, unlike in prison. So you have McMurphy, whose initials are RPM, suggesting the kind of energy that he's running, and opposed to him, you have the woman who's Nurse Ratched, who is Big Nurse, who is basically the power source there at the hospital, the one who's controlling everything. You've got those two opposing forces. And so Nurse Ratched represents what the novel calls the Combine, this collective, I think you were calling it, was like military-industrial complex. That kind of language is just starting to surface also in the late 1950s. And I think it's actually Eisenhower who is using that kind of language. He is the first one who really talks about that, and talks about it as a kind of danger.
Yeah.
And so the novel uses this notion of the Combine. There's some kind of machinery that is controlling pretty much the way we do things. And Nurse Ratched is representative. I mean, she's the one who kind of embodies that. Now, between the two of them, and I'm now partly just recapping for those who've not been following along, you have Chief Bromden, who's committed to the hospital, who has been there for decades, who everybody thinks is deaf and dumb, but in fact is not. And it's with Chief Bromden. He is the narrator of the novel. And so it is through his eyes that we're getting the story. And it's the impact of McMurphy on Chief Bromden that is the primary catalyst or energy that the novel is finally going to work with. What we're watching is how Chief Bromden moves from a position of being entirely shut down as a human being towards some kind of action. And that's where we'll be arriving tomorrow, is what finally, of course, happens. Yesterday, just to touch again on this, there was a passage where the chief is thinking about McMurphy and thinking about all that McMurphy, the kind of freedom that McMurphy represents, a kind of Western male freedom is really what it is. And what he thinks to himself is that he's what he is, that's it. Maybe that makes him strong enough, being what he is. The Columbine hasn't gotten to him in all these years. What makes that nurse think she's going to be able to do it in a few weeks? Later, hiding in the latrine, this is the chief narrating, I take a look at my own self in the mirror and wonder how it was possible that anybody could manage such an enormous thing as being what he was. And that's a line, again, I was saying yesterday, this is right in the middle of the novel. This is smack dab in the middle of the novel. And it is, in some ways, the key turning point. And this is what the chief, and he's hiding in the latrine as he's thinking this. This is also indicative that this is somebody, this is a guy who is, you know, 6'8 or something like that, a massive, massive, powerful man potentially, but sees himself as incredibly small and vulnerable and weak. But in the mirror, looking in the mirror, it's like something is starting to awaken. How could anybody manage such an enormous thing as being what he was? I was struck at lunch, at dinner tonight, when the announcements were being posted over the microphone, and the kids, I think, are gathering at this time and getting free ice cream, right? And they're having a conversation about gender, about what it is to be a man and what it is to be a woman. And it's curious, because that's a question that I think this novel is raising as well. And we were touching on this yesterday as well, that McMurphy is a certain image of a certain kind of man, certainly not ideal in my mind. I mean, there's a strong threat of violence running through his. I mean, he's in prison for a reason. But clearly, Chief Bromden is seizing on this quality about him. He is fully himself, and there's something so powerful about that. He goes on, and he's looking in the mirror, right, thinking, that ain't me, that ain't my face. It wasn't even me when I was trying to be that face. It wasn't even really me then, when he was young and out in the world. I was just being the way I looked, the way people wanted. It don't seem like I have ever been me. How can McMurphy be what he is? And one of the things we were talking about yesterday, and it's an odd connection, Marilyn Monroe also dies in 1962. And Marilyn Monroe, I just finished reading a really interesting biography about her. And I mean, she creates a persona that's Marilyn. And throughout her career, she is fighting, in some ways, you know, having created a persona, she's also fighting to maintain control of that persona and maintain control of who she actually is. She's trying to discover who she is, even as she's created this enormously successful persona. There was a time when she may have been the most famous person in the world. Right? Enormously successful persona. At the same time, having been raised in an abusive, you know, as an abused kid, no father, and so on, there's all these questions, all this exploration that she's doing, therapeutically, actually, with psychiatrists, and doing a ton of reading, a lot of reading, just exploring, trying to figure out, in the midst of this worldwide adulation for Marilyn Monroe. And it actually, as I was reading this yesterday, I was reminded of her. I was just being the way I looked, the way people wanted. Don't seem like I've ever been me. How can Murphy be what he is? In the next part of the novel, I'm going to hand out these pages and we're going to move in this general direction. If you would just pass those around. Not surprisingly, having just had that scene, what we get in the next part of the novel is Chief Bromden beginning to reflect, really for the first time, certainly the first time in the novel, but he also indicates to us that this is the first time in years that he's reflected back on his own life, on his own childhood. So there is this, again, a kind of therapeutic process going on. And by therapeutic, I'm taking that in a sort of etymologically literal sense. Therapy has to do with healing. And so there is some kind of healing that's taking place for this character. So he's lying in bed. What happens in this section is that McMurphy gets a bunch of the patients signed up for a fishing trip all off the coast of Oregon. he's able to do this because the doctor goes, it turns out the doctor's a big fisherman, and it's the one time he kind of bucks Big Nurse, right? So the doctor goes along, and you get these people signed up. And the chief, you know, the chief's first act of rebellion in some ways is to raise his hand to sign up for the fishing trip, basically, even though he's deaf and dumb. So the fishing trip is about to take place, and it's not surprising that it's a fishing trip. This is also moving the novel towards recasting McMurphy as a kind of Christ figure, quite honestly. And so the fishing trip ties into Jesus, the fish, and so on and so forth. My memory actually is that there's 12 guys who go along. And what's happening at with McMurphy is that from being a kind of solo operator, he's starting to see himself as committed. It's a funny sort of a pun on this word committed. He's committed to the Mental Institute, but he's becoming committed actually to these men who look up to him and see him as someone who can change things. So here you have Chief Bromden. A couple pages before the handout, he's lying in bed the night before the fishing trip, is thinking about it. And I'm just going to read these passages. There's too much to Xerox. I thought it over about my being deaf, about the years of not letting on I heard what was said. And I wondered if I could ever act any other way again. And so again, we're not on these pages yet.
Oh.
Okay. We're getting there. But I remembered one thing. It wasn't me that started acting deaf. It was people that first started acting like I was too dumb to hear or see or say anything. It hadn't been just since I came in the hospital either. People first took to acting like I couldn't hear or talk a long time before that. In the army, anybody with more stripes acted that way toward me. I tried to think back when I first noticed it. You know, what he's experiencing, what he's recognizing is that he was invisible to a lot of people. And he thinks all the way back to when he was 10 years old. He says, I think it was once when we were still living in the village on the Columbia. His family is from the area around the Columbia River, just at the northern part of Oregon. I'm about 10 years old. I'm out in front of the shack when he sees a car pull up. And there's a couple of government officials in the car. They're looking for his father, and he's there as a 10-year-old boy, and they start having these conversations as if he's not there, about, well, how do we approach the chief, and, you know, what do we do? And finally, it's the woman who says, well, no, let's not talk to the chief today, not yet. I think, you know, you recall the record we have shows the wife is not Indian but white. A woman from town, her name is Bromden. He took her name, not she his. Oh yes, I think if we just leave now and go back into town, and of course spread the word with the townspeople about the government's plan so they understand the advantages of having a hydroelectric dam and a lake instead of a cluster of shacks beside a falls, then type up an offer and mail it to the wife, you see, by mistake, I feel our job will be a great deal easier. And the 10-year-old boy is standing there hearing all this, and they're totally ignoring him. She looks off to the men. Whereas if we meet now with the husband and make some abrupt offer, we may run up against untold of Navajo stubbornness. And if we know anything about American Indians, of course, the Navajo are not in Oregon. So she's just using, I mean, Navajo is kind of her word for Indian. I start to tell them he's not Navajo, but think what's the use if they don't listen. They don't care what tribe he is, and so on. So he begins to experience himself as invisible. And just to sidetrack, how many of you are familiar with Ralph Ellison's novel Invisible Man, which is published in 1953? It's still maybe the greatest African-American novel, and certainly one of the greatest American novels of the 20th century. And Invisible Man, and the beginning of that is, I mean, the whole premise is that as an African-American male in this country, he experiences himself as invisible. And there's a huge irony that the novel plays with, because there's a way in which, as a black man, he's incredibly visible. Right? But in fact, people aren't seeing him. They are seeing the color of his skin and drawing conclusions from that, as opposed to actually seeing the individual. And one of the striking things about that novel is that Ellison makes a comparison between the experience of a black man and the experience of a beautiful woman. He makes a very explicit comparison, saying that, and it's not quite like this, but the basic idea is that for a beautiful woman, it's a very similar situation. That is, she's very visible in one sense. People notice her. But in another sense, she's entirely invisible because they're not interested in the actual human being. And this is exactly what Chief Bromden is experiencing. Right? And so all of his life, this has been his experience. And this is what finally leads him to being deaf and dumb. Right? To pretending to be deaf and dumb, because always his sense was that no one is hearing or seeing him. What happens next, and this is where we get into this passage, it's late at night. We find out that Chief Bromden, who has no money, really, keeps chewing the same gum over and over again every day. It's like at night, he'll take it out, he'll stick it underneath his bed, right? And in the morning, you know, he'll start chewing it again. And he's been doing this for years. And one of the assistants comes along and discovers finally where Chief Bromden is hiding his gum. And he's, McMurphy is in the bed beside Chief Bromden's. McMurphy is awake. They start talking. This assistant is telling McMurphy about this gum. And McMurphy says, Chief, I want you to tell me something. He starts singing this song. Oh, does the spearmint lose its flavor on the midmost overnight? Your mother says, don't chew it, do you swallow it in spite? So on and so forth. Starts joking with the chief. And then what he does is he hands the chief a piece of chewing gum. And this is page 186. And that's where you should have your page picking up. So we'll pick up at a couple of paragraphs in. He held out that last note and twiddled it down like a feather. So if somebody could just start reading at that point, that'd be great. So read a few paragraphs.
He held out that last note and twiddled it down like a feather. I couldn't help but start to chuckle, and this made me scared and get to laughing and not be able to stop. But just then, McMurphy jumped off his bed and went to rustling through his nightstand in a hush. I clenched my teeth, wondering what to do. It had been a long time since I let anyone hear me do any more than grunt or bellow. I heard him shut the bedstand, and it echoed like a boiler door. I heard him say, here, and something lit on my bed. Little, just the size of a lizard or a snake. Juicy fruit is the best I can do for you at the moment, Chief. Package I want off scan one, pinchy pennies, and he got back in the bed. And before I realized what I was doing, I told him thank you. He didn't say anything right off.
So we should pause briefly right at that moment. Because this is the first time he has spoken out loud to anybody in probably 20 years, right? And sort of without thinking. And it's something as small as McMurphy handing him a piece of chewing gum. Right? But on the other hand, when was the last time in Bromden's life when somebody gave him a gift? Right? And this is an aspect about McMurphy. I mean, he just does this. He just gives this away. Right? And so that thank you is, it's like, if this were a stage production, there would just be this. It's like, what just happened? What just happened? Yeah. Okay, sorry to interrupt. Yeah, so please continue.
He didn't say anything right off. He was up on his elbow, watching me the way he watched the black boy, waiting for me to say something else. I picked up the package of gum from the bedspread and held it in my hand and told him, thank you. It didn't sound like much because my throat was rusty and my tongue creaked. He told me I sounded a little out of practice and laughed at that. I tried to laugh once, but it was a squawking sound, like a pullet trying to crow. It sounded more like crying than laughing.
And that, too, is worth pausing on. Okay. It sounded more like crying than laughing. So let's just, what's the significance of that?
One year without anything. Yeah. How else could it sound?
Exactly.
It was a cry for help?
Yes, exactly. Yeah. Sure. Yeah. Yeah. That's why I wanted to pause on it, just to kind of, to emphasize. That this sound that comes out that is it's an attempt to be a laugh, comes out more like a cry, which does really reflect what he's feeling, in fact. Yeah, sorry, please. You're doing great.
He told me not to hurry, that he had until 6:30 in the morning to listen if I wanted to practice. He said a man been still long as me saw I couldn't say anything, he crossed his hands behind his head and started talking to himself. "You know, Chief, I was just remembering a time down in the Willamette Valley. I was picking beans outside of Eugene and considering myself damn lucky to get the job. It was in the early 30s, so there wasn't many kids able to get jobs. I got the job by proving to the bean boss I could pick just as fast and clean as any of the adults. Anyway, I was the only kid in the rows. Nobody else turned around, nobody else around me but grown-ups. And after I tried a time or two to talk to them, I saw they weren't for listening to me. Scrawny little patch quilt redhead anyhow. So I hushed. I was so peeved at them not listening to me, I kept hushed. The livelong 4 weeks I picked that field, working right alongside of them, listening to them prattle on about this uncle or that cousin. Or if somebody didn't show up for work, gossip about him. 4 weeks and not a peep out of me. Till I think, by God, they forgot I could talk. Lost off the old bastards, I bided my time. Then on the last day, I opened up and went to tell them what a pretty bunch of farts they were. I told each one just how his buddy had dragged him over the coals when he was absent. Hoo-wee! Did they listen then? They finally got to arguing with each other and created such a shitstorm I lost my quarter cent pound bonus I had coming for not missing the day because I already had a bad reputation around town and a bean boss claimed the disturbance was likely my fault even if he couldn't prove it. I cussed him out too. By shooting off my mouth that time probably cost me $20 or so. Well worth it too."
Okay, let's pause there for a second. So, yeah, anything in what McMurphy is saying here to the chief? This is a long story that he tells him, right?
Mm-hmm.
It's a pretty long story. You can just look at that paragraph. And it goes on and on. So,
he's just telling us he doesn't want to talk, he doesn't have to.
Okay.
Empathy.
Yeah.
I've been there too. I know what it's like.
Yeah. So be more specific. I mean, because McMurphy's pretty specific. I mean, it's remarkable how the story actually connects to the chief.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
He's
yeah.
kind of encouraging him to, you know, all of this now. Shoot your mouth off.
That is exactly where this is going,
yeah.
for sure. Yeah.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. Yeah. You know, it's
I
like.
I know you saw it, chief. I saw it. I've been listening. I know we've been listening. Yeah, I've been talking, but you've been listening.
Exactly.
I know
yeah.
it's in there, Chief.
Yeah, yeah.
I've got
yeah.
until 6:30 tomorrow morning. I've got all night
right.
to wait for you to talk.
Yeah, yeah. It's actually pretty clever, you know, on McMurphy's part. And again, this is an indication of something about his character. Right? So first of all, it's like the chief says something to him. Try to imagine yourself in his situation. It's like, whoa. Okay, so what do you do? McMurphy waits and then says, you know, yeah, it's like I've got all night if you got something more to say. And then silence, which is also not surprising. And then what does McMurphy do? Now, I even like that detail. When he saw I couldn't say anything, he crossed his hands behind his head, and started talking himself. So it's that sort of gesture. I mean, there's a casualness about it. All right, he's not jumping up. He's not going over. He's giving the chief plenty of space, would be a way of putting it. Treating it very casually. And so he launches into the story. You know, Chief, I was just remembering a time down in the Willamette Valley. And then he's off. And this ties into this, you know, the importance of storytelling. I mean, it's really very effective the way he works this.
I had the feeling it may not even be true.
Yes.
Oh, that sounds
bad. Yeah. That's also possible. It's also possible.
Well, but it's in character.
It's very much in character.
Yeah.
yeah. Right.
But I thought also it would be in character for him to make the whole story up, knowing
yeah.
it
that's the case, and we don't know, but if that's the case, it's also an indication of how has he used his ability, his trickery before, primarily for his own benefit. And here, he's clearly telling this story, not really for his benefit. He's telling this story for the chief's benefit. Mm-hmm. Right? And it's specific. After I tried a time or two to talk to them, I saw they weren't for listening to me. Scrawny little patch quilt, redhead anyhow. That's exactly what we've got. Two pages before, as the chief was remembering being 10 years old and being invisible. And McMurphy wasn't privy to that, those thoughts. But the implication is, you know, if we buy this, you know, we can also say, well, this is Kesey, you know, reaching too far, that McMurphy would somehow launch, you know, connect into this. But it makes sense. I mean, McMurphy, as a con artist also, he reads people really well. I think he really reads people. And so, I mean, here you've got this Indian who's been deaf and dumb for 20 years. Why has he been acting this way? Well, McMurphy's been around. It's like, well, of course, you know, nobody's listening to you. Right? And so that's what leads to, you know, what's next. He chuckled a while to himself, remembering, then turned his head on his pillow and looked at me. And now there's direct engagement with him. Right? He's given the chief a lot of space. He's told this story, kind of opened things up casually, and then he turns. And so would somebody continue reading? We pick up, yeah, he chuckled a while to himself.
He chuckled a while to himself, remembering, then turned his head on his pillow and looked at me. But I was wondering, Chief, are you hiding your time, biding your time, towards the day you decide to lay into them? No, I told him I couldn't. Couldn't tell them off is easier than you think. You're a lot bigger, tougher than I am, I mumbled. How's that? I didn't get you, Chief. I worked some spit down in my throat. You are bigger and tougher than I am. You can do it. Me, are you kidding? Blimey, look at you. You stand a head taller than any man in the world. There ain't a man here you couldn't turn every way but loose, and that's a fact. No, I'm way too little. I used to be big, but not now. No more, I'm not no more. You're twice the size of me. Oh boy, you are crazy, aren't you? The first thing I saw when I came to this place was you sitting over there in that chair, big as a damn mountain. I tell you, I lived all over Klamath and Texas and Oklahoma and all over around Gallup. I swear you're the biggest Indian I ever saw. I'm from Columbia Gorge, I said, and he waited for me to go on. My papa was a full chief, and his name was Tia Milituna. That means the pine that stands tallest on the mountain, and we didn't live on a mountain. He was real big when I was a kid. My mother got twice his size. He must have had a real moose of an old lady. How big was she? Oh, big, big. I mean, how many feet and inches? Feet and inches? A guy at the carnival looked her over and says 5'9" and weighed 130 pounds. That was only because he just saw her. She got bigger all the time. Yeah, how much bigger? Bigger than Papa and me together. Just one day took to a growing, huh? Well, that's a new one on me. I never heard of an Indian woman doing something like that. She wasn't Indian. She was a town woman from the Dalles. And her name was what? Brahmda? Yeah, I see. Wait a minute. He thinks for a while and says, and when a town woman marries an Indian, that's marrying somebody beneath her, ain't it? Yeah, I think I see. No, it wasn't just her that made him little. Everybody worked on him because he was big and wouldn't give in and did like he pleased. Everybody worked on him just the way they're working on you. They who, Chief? He said, Chief, I'm getting lost. They who? They who, Chief? He asked in a soft voice, suddenly serious.
And just a pause there.
Yeah.
Right, it's suddenly serious in a soft voice. This is McMurphy, who we don't associate with a soft voice. And what Chief Bromden is, everybody worked on him just the way they're working on you. And so it's like, so now McMurphy is aware that this, the chief really has some, you know, he has this insight. He sees what's going on. And of course, this whole thing about the combine and the wires and the way, the, you know, the mother got big. Yeah, crazy talk. But inside the crazy talk, basically the crazy talk, these are metaphors for what's actually going on. It was going on in his family, and then Chief Bromden sees that there's something, it's not just his family, it wasn't just the tribe, it's really going on all over the country. There is something that's been taking over in a way, you know, and they're working on just the way they're working on you. And so McMurphy suddenly, it's like, ooh, this is getting interesting for him. Okay.
The combine. It worked on him for years. He was big enough to fight it for a while. It wanted us to live in inspected houses. It wanted to take the falls. It was even in the tribe, and they worked on him. In the town, they beat him up in the alleys. But cut his hair short once. Oh, the combine's big, big. He fought it a long time till my mother made him too little to fight anymore, and he gave up. McMurphy didn't say anything for a long time after that. Then he raised up on his elbow and looked at me again and asked why they beat him up in the alleys. And I told him that they wanted to make him see what he had in store for him, only worse if he didn't sign the papers giving everything to the government. What did they want to give him to give to the government? Everything. The tribe, the village, the falls. Now I remember. You're talking about the falls where the Indians used to spear salmon, a long time ago. Yeah, but the way I remember it, the tribe got paid some huge amount. That's what they said to him. He said, how can you pay me for the way a man lives? He said, what can you pay for what a man is? They didn't understand, not even the tribe. They stood out in front of our door all holding those checks. And they wanted him to tell them what to do now. They kept asking him to invest for them or tell them where to go or to buy a farm. But he was too little anymore. And he was too drunk, too. The combine had whipped him. It beats everybody. It will beat you, too. They can't have somebody as big as Papa running around unless he's one of them. You can see that. Yeah, I reckon I can.
So let's pause there as well. These lines echo, I think, what Bromden was experiencing earlier when he was thinking about what is this quality in McMurphy. And he remembers his father saying, what can you pay for the way a man lives? He said, what can you pay for what a man is? So that's that same quality. What can you pay for what a man is? What does he mean by that? It's kind of a strange sentence. What can you pay for what a man is? What's at stake here?
His life, his beliefs, his values,
yeah,
are all wrapped up in that land, and there's no way.
Exactly.
He can buy it.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah, yeah. It is. It's his identity. It's who he is. Right? And that is what's at stake. And the chief has an awareness that you start to give this away and you flood that land and so on, then whatever the amount of money that you're getting for that, it's not gonna make any difference because you've lost something essential. Yeah. 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 And the combine had whipped him. So let's just pause again on this whole notion of the combine too. So what is this worked on him for years. What is it? And we talked about it in terms of sort of military industrial complex, but
in this case it's the Bureau of Indian Affairs and probably
yeah.
Water and power.
Yep, So specifically, that's who the people who came, you know, to try to buy the land presumably did represent that particular government entity, yeah, Bureau of Indian Affairs.
And they did buy the Klamath land, and they logged it and got more money than they paid the Indians for it.
Yes.
And so they got their money back and the land.
Yes, exactly right. Yes, yeah. Yeah, and this is a famous scene, the flooding of I want to say it's Chililo, again, right along the Columbia. I mean, it's a very, very famous story of the loss of that land and what it did to those people. So this is not something that Kesey is making up. It is a famous story. So certainly, Bureau of Indian Affairs. Beyond that. And I'm thinking about, again, I'm going back to Kesey, born 1938, University of Oregon, going down to California. He's in his, you know, teens, early 20s. What's going on in the 50s, post-World War II, economic boom years, absolutely. You know, the development, real development of the suburbs. And, you know, what we think of or thought of as the American way of life. Chicken in every pot and a car in every whatever. I mean, there was just this overriding sense of material prosperity.
And greed.
Yeah. And absolutely, yeah, and greed. Yeah. And there was a certain emphasis on conformity. That everybody has to do, you know, certain, you know, yeah, there were certain roles. I mean, I'm my mother has told me more than once. She married 1945, met my dad right at the tail end of World War II. I was saying to folks yesterday, he had to leave. He was in the Battle of the Bulge, had to leave in March or April of 45 to come back to the States, meets my mom. They start dating in Chicago. They're married by August of 1945, right? And most of that time they weren't even together. He was in Texas. He didn't get sent back because the war in Germany ended. Okay. So they get married in 1945. G.I. Bill, he's in law school, and she's working at the Chicago Tribune, right? Helping to support as he's in law school. He finishes law school in 1948. Almost immediately she stops working. She's pregnant. My older brother's born in 1950. I'm born in 1953. And she doesn't work professionally for another 15 or 20 years. A lot of volunteer work. Right? And I've asked her, you know, would you have actually liked to continue to work at the Tribune? Oh, yeah, absolutely. Absolutely. Right? She was not born to be a housewife. She really didn't want to be home. And she wasn't. I mean, she was volunteering at the hospital or whatever. She would have loved to continue to work. It wasn't. She didn't see it as an option.
Yeah.
Right? Nobody worked.
But I think the American dream was a male dream. It wasn't a female dream at all.
Well, this is partly what, again, yesterday we were saying, Betty Friedan's Feminine Mystique, born, you know, was published 1963, and it was exploring exactly some of these questions. Mm. Yes. Yeah. So the combine, in some ways, is all of this.
You know, it reminds me too. It's a total lack of any valuing of that other culture.
Yeah.
They don't really expect any of these Indians to really be smart enough for one thing.
Absolutely.
Or to look forward enough to. They just want the money.
Right.
And then they come across this father who is smart enough and doesn't want the money.
Yes.
And we do the same. I was just thinking when we started talking about this, how many times have we had a new superhighway built through a quote, nice neighborhood?
Right, yeah.
They always go through the ghetto. They always go through the poor areas because, hey, they don't want the money. And yet there's, I know...
Well, they don't have the political clout.
Beautiful, yeah. Beautiful neighborhoods that were not rich neighborhoods, but they were split by the freeway and that just destroyed their...
But it is interesting in a certain way that he held his chief and he was holding certain values, but you're saying that the other members of his tribe weren't holding the same values.
Right.
That's correct.
They were...
Yeah. And the novel does make that very clear. It's that he was undermined also within the tribe. Yeah, yeah. So let's just finish off this section. And somebody else can pick up with... yeah, so I'll just read that line. That's why you shouldn't have broke that window. They see you're big now. Now they got to bust you. That's a reference to the very end of the last section. Big Nurse has... apparently won a round against McMurphy and has clamped down on everybody on the ward and has taken away some of their rights, essentially. And McMurphy's response is he gets up, he goes over to where the nurse's office is, and there's a window, a glass window, that separates the room from her office. And she keeps the cartons of cigarettes that everybody has back behind the window, and he goes up and he punches his fist through her window, and you know, takes, you know, oh, I'm so sorry, he says, didn't see that window there. And that, subsequently in the novel, two or three more times he punches his fist through that window, and that's the response. And you know, we'll come back to this question tomorrow as we see in the climax of the novel what finally happens between Big Nurse and McMurphy, and how McMurphy, I mean, his only response at that point is violence, basically, right? And there is something liberating about that moment for everybody on that floor, right? In terms of the novel, it's a liberating moment, what he has just done. Right? And so that's what the chief is referencing here. You shouldn't have done that, right? Because now they know just how big you are. One can go right back to 1960s, the Black Panther movement, the American Indian movement, AIM, where they finally said, you know, we're not going to take this anymore. If you're going to come into our neighborhood with guns, we're going to meet you with guns. Right? I'm not affirming that as a decision, but that was clearly part of the energy of the times. So if someone would pick up, you know, after, now they got to bust you. Sleepy. I didn't want to talk anymore. I tried to think back.
didn't seem like what I had wanted to say. I've been talking crazy.
And that's where the Xerox leaves off. And McMurphy says, yeah, you've been talking crazy, but says, I didn't say it didn't make sense, Chief. I just said it was talking crazy. Mm-hmm. In other words, it makes perfect sense what you're saying. You know, mm-hmm. he's following all of this. And then the question, obviously, the final part of the novel leaves us with this dilemma. I mean, how do you fight the Combine? Right? I mean, can you continually punch your fist through the glass? You know, do you use violence to try to overcome what is so massive and amorphous? What do you do? And we're out of time, so we'll finish the novel tomorrow. Thank you again for going along on the ride.
Thank you.